from the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare, the hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
Into left center field and deep. This is a tie ball game.
1-1 pitch. Not only can I not remember the last time I broadcast a game this good, I can't remember the last time I've seen a game this enjoyable, this entertaining.
The premier baseball show in Chicago, Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel.
Bob Costas to Tony Kubek, the archetypal baseball voices of my youth. How about yours? And Bob, a baseball voice of the present, still doing great work. Doing play-by-play on MLB Network. You can see him this Wednesday. The Yanks and the Mets in New York. And then July 3rd, the Phillies and the Cubs. Both of those games on MLB Network. And Bob Costas joins me, Matt Spiegel, here on Hit and Run right now on the Circa Resort and Casino Hotline. You can download CircaLasVegas.com. Good morning, Bob. How are you?
Hey, Matt, thank you. You're too kind, because if you're going to talk about baseball on NBC in that era, you've got to include Vin Scully and Joe Garagiola. I'm just happy to be grouped with them along with Tony Kubek.
Well, truth be told, I would do all four of you as the archetypal baseball voices of my youth. How many do I get? I need Bob Starr and Ken Coleman and Joe Castiglione as well. I need Bill White and Phil Rizzuto. Is archetypal just one? Because I might be in trouble already.
Well, I think the list has to be limited. It can't be endless. And the fact that you bounced around from city to city,
I know,
changes your perspective. You know, if you go back, if you're a real Cub fan,
yes,
and you're of a certain age, you remember the most, I think, under-celebrated great baseball announcer I've ever heard, Jack Quinlan, who died before he was 40 years old, I believe hit by a car during spring training in Arizona in the mid-1960s.
Wow.
Used to call not only the Cubs on the radio, but would do national broadcasts of the All-Star Game and the World Series. And I'm kind of a student of this. I think he is easily one of the 10 best baseball announcers I have ever heard from any era. And then, of course, you go through the years, and you've got Harry Carey, and you've got Milo Hamilton, and et cetera, and now Pat Hughes, all of them in the broadcaster's wing of the Baseball Hall of Fame, and I'm leaving some people out. So, you know, everyone has their favorites, and usually, as long as the person is at a certain level of competence, usually the deciding factor is that guy the voice of my team?
Well, understood. But, it, you know, I grew up in New Jersey. I could have added Harry Callis on 1210 WCIU. So because there were all these different voices in the soup. But, you know, you mentioned Jack Quinlan to me when you were a guest on my podcast on the PBP, Voices of Baseball, last year. I need to go back and find a Jack Quinlan game archived somewhere and just hang out with it. Because I don't know it well enough. I wondered, Bob, you know, among all that you've done, I think it's 9 Olympic Games. Obviously, it'd be the NFL studio work with Pete Axtell and everybody is iconic. The Bulls NBA Finals with Matty Gukas and more. I mean, there are a million things and realms of your work. I mean, the beautiful essays before Sunday Night Football within the past decade. Where does the Sandberg game rank in terms of, you know, items that you're proud of and proud of the association in retrospect?
Well, it's the greatest regular season baseball game I've ever broadcast. You know, postseason games, World Series games are in a different category because of the stakes. But it really is an iconic game. When you say, especially around Chicago, the Sandberg game, everybody knows what you're talking about. Game 7 in 2016, the most important game of a Cub involving the Cubs that's ever been broadcast, because back in 1908, there was no radio, let alone television. But no one calls that the Ben Zobrist game or the Kyle Hendricks game or the David Ross game. But the Sandberg game, everybody knows what you're talking about. And the only other game I can think of that has a name was the year before, the Pine Tar game with George Brett. But that was a subject of controversy when they briefly disallowed a Brett home run because too much pine tar on the bat. And Kansas City was the visiting team, so it didn't have anything like the drama that the Sandberg game had. And don't take it from me, every time I cross paths with Ryne Sandberg, we're immediately connected. Before the first word is spoken, each of us knows what the other is thinking. And I spoke with Tony Kubek just the other day. He's 88 and still very, very sharp.
Wow, I love
it. And he said that when he received the Ford Frick Award, which is the broadcaster's equivalent of the Hall of Fame, and gave his speech in Cooperstown in, I think, 2009 or 2010. When he crossed paths that weekend with Ryne Sandberg, Ryne said to him, the way NBC captured that game has a lot to do with my career. That was not just the biggest game of my career. It put me on the map, which it did, because younger listeners now may not appreciate this. But the game of the week was not just a random game that happened to be on network television. It was truly the game of the week. If you lived in a non-baseball city, that was the one time you got to see Johnny Bench face Fernando Valenzuela or whatever it might have been. The content wasn't as readily available as now. You didn't have all the highlight shows. You didn't have stuff on your phone. It was truly the game of the week. In fact, the players all around baseball referred to it as the game of the world. Mm-hmm. If they saw Scully and Gary Fiola or me and Kubek at the batting cage on Friday, you'd hear people say, oh, we're the game of the world tomorrow, because they knew that was the only game that the whole baseball world might be watching unless they were playing at exactly the same time.
I wonder if it's impossible for a regular season game in any sport to cut through the way that did at the time because of the context you're adding.
I think it's difficult. You know, NFL games are one a week, and a Sunday night NFL game has the entire football-watching audience. They have their attention. Mm-hmm. Or the game that's at 4 o'clock on either Fox or CBS might be, if it's a great enough game. I think any game, there are games involving Michael Jordan in the regular season when he had the 55-point game in the regular season at Madison Square Garden shortly after he came back, like only a few games after he came back from playing baseball. A few. But not that many.
Yeah, I do. It's remarkable the way that really did break through for Ryne. I mentioned this earlier in the show. I've made the corollary to say Elton John at the Troubadour in 1970. Just like suddenly everyone knew what a talent he was. And was that talent? You know, do we understate the talent on some levels? Like, this is a guy who Sandberg could do just about everything you needed to do on the field in all facets.
Yeah, he was a Gold Glove second baseman. He fit the role. It looked like Central Casting kind of sent somebody in for that role. He hit for average and for power. You know, he was an iconic player in his time, and that game. You have to, again, context matters. The Cubs had been lovable losers for a very long time, and the baseball world was not convinced that they could be contenders. That game wasn't just about Sandberg, and it's not incidental that they were playing the Cardinals, because that helped the atmosphere. No lights at Wrigley Field for another 5 years or so after that. So it's a beautiful Saturday afternoon, sun-drenched, the attention of the baseball world focused on it. The game is insane. Winds up 12-11 in 11 innings on a base hit by Davey Owen. And that's a great thing about baseball. Very often the person who turns out Sandberg's the hero. But, you know, a supporting player is Davey Owen. Sometimes that's just the guy who comes up to bat. I think he might have been the last guy on the bench for Jim Fry. Might have been the last option available, gets the game-winning hit over a drawn-in infield in the 11th inning. The game is just so totally insane, but it marked the Cubs as legitimate contenders. It marked Sandberg as not just a star, but a candidate for MVP, and he did win the MVP. And the Cubs go on from there to come within a game of the World Series. It's a painful memory for Cub fans. They're up 2-0 as they leave Chicago after winning the first two at Wrigley, go out to San Diego. Back then, the LCS was best of five, and the Padres won all three in San Diego, including Game 5, which the Cubs led 3-0 behind Rick Sutcliffe, who won the Cy Young Award, and I think was 16-1 after the Cubs acquired him from Cleveland in a trade during the season. If ever, anything ever seemed like a lock, it was that game, and it slipped away. So not only were the Cubs denied a trip to the World Series, still waiting at that point since 1945 to be in it, and since 1908 to win it, but I remember how I felt about it. The World Series in 84 was on NBC. Vin and Joe were going to call it. I was going to host it from the ballparks. And if the Cubs had managed one more win against the Padres, that World Series would have been Tigers-Cubs at Tiger Stadium and at Wrigley Field. Could anything be more retro-appealing than that? Nothing against San Diego. I was so disappointed when the Cubs lost the fifth game. I just thought from a national standpoint, it would have been just such a wonderful World Series, and it would have evoked all kinds of memories, but we just missed it.
Oh, boy. Bob Costas joining us right here on Hit and Run on 670 The Score. Do people still blame you for the sins of the network and asking you why Willie McGee was named player of the game before the second home run? It wasn't your fault, Bob. Marv Albert was ready to call the fight that was going on afterwards, right?
Yeah, I guess some people do, even though there have been a couple of documentaries about the Sandberg game, and I patiently explained it. But, you know, here's one thing. This is an article of faith. You could have a fan who in every other way was a thoughtful and informed person. The guy could have multiple PhDs, but he becomes irrational when it comes to his team. So, of course, every network announcer in every sport is shortchanging your team, is somehow rooting against your team or rooting for the other team, when in truth, 99% of network broadcasters root for one thing and one thing only, a good game, a close game, an exciting event. We want the series to go seven because it's just better that way. It's more dramatic that way. But anyway, here's what happened in that circumstance, as I'll now explain it for the 10th time.
You don't have to. No, you don't have to. It's good. I loved your commentary right there about it. And it makes me want to zoom out even larger and say, don't you think sports is a backdrop for terrible and irrational thoughts safely? Like, I thought about this as Curb Your Enthusiasm finished. There was so much sports in that season and finale. It's like sports is where you go to get your absurd opinions off and then carry on with your day.
Correct. And it's generally harmless. When that level of irrationality and blind tribalism crosses over into our politics, as it has, then you have a very toxic situation. But I feel compelled, since I have your audience here, here's the deal. A show called Sports World followed the game of the week on that particular Saturday. Sports World was NBC's answer to ABC's iconic Wide World of Sports. And there was a fight in Panama. I forget who the fighters were. And they are literally standing by because the game went long, even though the general pace of play before the rules changes in MLB a couple of years ago, the general pace of play in the 80s was faster. But this game had a lot happening, and it went 11 innings. So they're literally holding the fighters in their dressing rooms. It's way past where the opening bell should have rung. And Marv Albert and the fight doctor, Ferdy Pacheco, are standing by. And so what the producers are telling us is that we're going to do a hot switch, as it's called. As soon as the game is over, as soon as we can put a period at the end of the last sentence, boom, we're going to Panama. So we're trying to clean up all our obligations before the game ends. Even then, I'm a young guy, but I'd seen enough baseball to know the game wasn't over. And by the way, Sandberg had homered off Suter in the ninth to tie it anyway. But Willie McGee, in the top of the 10th, hits a double that not only gives the Cardinals the lead again, it gives him the cycle. So at that point, if we've got to read this thing, which is sponsored, Willie McGee's the player of the game. Okay, now we got to get the credits in. They weren't rolling them on the screen, but I'm doing them verbally. But it didn't overlap the pitch. I get done with it, and I say, the 1-1 pitch. And that's when Sandberg hits the second home run. And the very next thing I say is, move over Willie McGee. We may have another player of the game. But, you know, through whatever blind loyalty people see this, somehow the Cubs and Sandberg were being disrespected.
Yeah.
So, okay. If that's what you want to think, Have at it.
Oh, my goodness. I love it. Bob, I have enjoyed swimming in all of the conversations that have taken place since the death of Willie Mays. I in terms of greatest living ball player, in terms of all of it, it just feels like one extra gift that he gives us. It here in this kind of quiet sports time, and with the Rickwood game as the backdrop, it's been lovely to swim in it. Joe Posnanski, in writing about him this week, said, used it sort of as a trope throughout his essay, you can see him even if you never saw him. And I love that, because I never saw him. What was it like to see him? What was it like to watch him play?
Well, I never broadcast a game in which he played, but I was a kid and saw him play at the Polo Grounds when I was like 5 years old. I barely remember it, but I remember my father pointing him out and saying, that's Willie Mays. So even then he knew that he was a significant player. And I remember watching many games of his from Candlestick Park or wherever on television. And I was in college when he played his last game, then as a New York Met, in the twilight of his career in the early 1970s. So I saw enough of him to know how wondrous he was. And statistics, as significant as they are in his case, don't do him justice, because you had to see him play. You had to feel the magnetism and the excitement and the joy that emanated from him as he played. And if you have time here, I'd like to make this point, which I've only made once before this past week. I was on a lot of radio and television shows talking about Willie. One of, I think, the most appealing things about baseball, at least baseball of past eras, is that the greatness of each iconic player, even though we inevitably compare them and we rank them, but the greatness of each does not dim or diminish the greatness of any of the others, because they each occupy a distinct place in our imagination. And I think sometimes, especially if it comes from those who never saw them, nothing wrong with that. I mean, I never saw Ty Cobb or Babe Ruth. You can't change when you were born, you know. But when you just go by war or by analytics, those things are helpful. They're fascinating. I'm interested in them. But it drains it of its humanity. So Ted Williams and Stan Musial are contemporaries. Williams' stats are somewhat better than Musial's, as great as Musial's were. But that doesn't dim what Musial meant to fans in St. Louis. They're distinctly different personalities, the tempestuous, splendid Splinter and the good-natured, smiling Stan the Man, one in Boston, one in St. Louis. DiMaggio is also a contemporary. Nothing Williams did or Musial did, both of whom had higher lifetime batting averages, takes away from DiMaggio's grace in center field, from the 56-game hitting streak, from all the mystique that surrounded him, marrying Marilyn Monroe and all the rest. You go ahead a generation. Willie, Mickey, and the Duke, the famous song. Willie is the greatest all-round player of the three. But Hank Aaron is the all-time, the authentic all-time home run king, who triumphed over not just a statistical barrier, but hatred and bigotry. He became, in the process, with his dignity and decency, a legitimate civil rights hero. So you can honestly say that by a small edge, Aaron was the better hitter of the two. But that doesn't change the fact that Willie was the greatest all-around player. Mickey Mantle went to his grave very upset with himself that he didn't fulfill his potential. But Mickey Mantle is the player most like Roy Hobbs in Bernard Malamud's novel, The Natural, and the movie that Barry Levinson made starring Robert Redford. His story is as much about what might have been as what was. And nothing changes the thrill it was to see Mickey Mantle at the plate, and the anticipation that he might hit a 500-foot home run, or before his legs betrayed him, the blinding speed he had, the greatest combination of power and speed of any player of his generation. Nothing Willie or Hank did, even though they exceeded Mantle in terms of career totals, takes away how poignant and powerful it was to see Mickey Mantle run out a home run through the lengthening shadows of a late Sunday afternoon at Yankee Stadium, in effect in the shadow of Joe DiMaggio, Lou Gehrig, and Babe Ruth, because that's Yankee mythology. None of that stuff to someone who understands what baseball means besides just cold, hard stats and facts. None of that stuff changes, no matter what the numbers do over the years.
That's beautiful stuff. I I find myself thinking about the joy with which he played, the joy with which he ran, and just the verve on the field. And I feel like that was part of what made people love him. And I wondered if you could cross sports with me or and just think about athletes that emanated that kind of excellence and the joy within the same career, within the same body of work that Willie did.
Well, it's not an exact comp because while he's a Hall of Famer and the definitive shortstop defensively, Ozzie Smith is not as monumental a player as Willie Mays, but Ozzie Smith emanated joy.
Yes.
You know, the backflips on opening day or the first game of a World Series and the way in which he played. And sometimes players who aren't overwhelming physically are more relatable to fans. You know, Ozzie Smith was a little guy who was excelling against players who are much larger physically. Magic Johnson is another example, not a little guy, a 6'9 point guard, which was unheard of at that time. But the smile on his face, you could relate to that. I guess we could find a whole list of others who weren't just good at what they did, but they made the viewer feel what they did.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I've been trying to get at. And that's why in these conversations about greatest living ball player and who gets to wear that, you know, if it is even such a thing. I mean, it was, I keep coming to Griffey. I keep coming to Ken Griffey Jr. just because of that joy and the comfort and the grace and kind of the awe that his peers have for him. I wondered where you stood on this idea.
When I was asked that question in the past few days, Griffey is the guy I settled on, too, because he is not tainted by a connection to performance-enhancing drugs. And he was a great, great player. Like Willie, a center fielder. Barry Bonds was a left fielder. Like Willie, a center fielder, a wall-scaling marvel as a center fielder. I think he won 10 gold gloves. Has the enormous batting stats, well over 600 home runs. And he played the game with a childlike joy, which is a comp to Willie Mays. Barry Bonds complicates the discussion because the pre-steroid Barry Bonds is one of the greatest all-round players of all time. Stole bases, hit for average and power, didn't have a great arm, but he did win gold gloves in left field. The tragedy, if that's not too overblown a word, of Barry Bonds is that he could have laid claim to that greatest living player designation that once belonged to his godfather, Willie Mays. If he had just played it straight, he might not have had 762 home runs, which is the statistical record, but the record in legend really belongs to Henry Aaron. He wouldn't have had those numbers. He wouldn't have had the video game numbers he had when he was 39, 40 years old, but he would have the respect and appreciation of the baseball world. He would long since be in the Hall of Fame, and he almost certainly would be the player who, without equivocation, we would now name as the greatest living player. But because of the complicating factor of the second portion of his career, I'm inclined to give that honor to Griffey.
Yeah, I am too. And I would urge folks to watch the 10th inning from Ken Burns' baseball, where you, Bob, are unsurprisingly eloquent, and that whole... the context that production gives to the humanity behind Barry Bonds and what happened, it made it kind of relatable and sad at the same time to me, you know?
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, again, this goes back to the kind of over-the-top hot take world that we live in, we were talking about before. Everything has to be binary. So if you say what I just said about Barry Bonds a moment ago, oh, you must hate Barry Bonds.
I know.
And no, far from it. In fact, I find a lot of things that are likable and admirable about him, and it makes it all the more poignant. You know, I don't claim to be as close to him as to be able to really unravel all this stuff, but clearly there was stuff from his dad and the way his dad was treated, the way Willie Mays was actually treated when he arrived in San Francisco, despite how joyous Willie was. He had some resentment toward the way he was treated through the years. Some of that landed on Barry, and Barry's a complicated personality. On the other hand, leave aside the statistics. When you listen to Barry Bonds talk about baseball and talk about hitting, he's your modern-day Ted Williams. He's a baseball savant. He's a very smart guy, period. And when it comes to baseball, he's a genius. He's telegenic. He has a beautiful smile. He's a well-spoken guy. He could have had the unmitigated love of the entire baseball public had it gone in a different way. And I'm not even faulting him for that.
Right.
You know, we all carry whatever baggage we carry. And some of that took him, and by all credible accounts, this is the way it happened. He saw what McGuire and Sosa were doing. They were getting all the attention. And he said, I'm better than them, which he was all around. If they're doing it, I'm going to do it. He did it, and he became superhuman. And you would think, or he thought, well, case closed. That settles it. No, it complicated it.
Yeah. Bob, wonderful talking to you. I look forward to seeing you in St. Elo later on this afternoon. Do you have inside knowledge? Do you have inside knowledge on what the statue is? I have my guess, but I don't have the knowledge.
Don't.
You don't?
I have no inside knowledge at all. When they drop the curtain, I'll be finding out along with everybody else.
All right. Well, Bob, thanks so much for the time, and thanks for all the communication through these past couple of years. I've enjoyed it greatly. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
Take care.
Bye.
You got it. It's Bob Costas on Hit and Run on 670 The Score. For the record, I'm guessing Sandberg on defense. In a little bit of a crouch, knees bent, glove and arm out, waiting for a ball. I don't have inside knowledge on this, but with Mully and Haw the other morning, he referenced the ivy. So like, and so now I'm thinking that like the wall is off in the distance behind him defensively. You know, you can see it. It's like that somehow that's there, but I don't really know. I'll see it this afternoon. What a joy to talk to Bob Costas. We'll go around the league a little bit and take a look at the leaderboard as well here on Hit and Run. And a moment from Friday's White Sox game with a broadcaster towing the line. We'll get to all of that on 670 The Score's Hit and Run before the top of the hour.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking spokes puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.
Fly ball, deep left field. Looking up is Pete Crow Armstrong and Francisco Alvarez for the second straight day with a solo home run. And the Mets are on the board.
This is why you got to stay with it. When you're at Wrigley Field, anything could happen. Any ball hit in the air today has a chance to go out.
Wow! They made him. That is, you know what? That is too much peer pressure. Grow a spine, man.
Obviously not a leader.
The premier baseball show in Chicago. Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel.
All right, I heard Ron Darling. I'm not sure who the other folks were. That was not Keith Hernandez. That was not Gary Cohen. That's Mets TV. Not sure who it was, but whoever said grow a spine for the Mets fan who caught the Francisco Alvarez home run and then got peer pressured in the bleachers to throw it back onto the field. He's wearing a Mets hat. He threw his own team's home run back onto the field. It's a funny line for the dude to say grow a spine. I got to say, it's a lot of fun out there, man. It's a lot of fun. And if you're having a good time and you're having a couple and there's like 40 people around you screaming at you to throw it back and that's just what, it's what we do here. I understand. I understand what that dude did. And you could say, Spiegel, you're a flip-flopper. It makes sense. Yeah, you would do that. And I'd say, you know, what are you talking about? Oh, what are you doing? You're inside my head now. What are you doing? No, I mean, like, it's understandable. I think it's understandable. I'm not going to go firing off on that guy.
And you don't want to upset it all of left field. Like, you know, yeah. Come on, you're your team. You're against right field. That's how it works.
You're no longer a Mets fan. You're a right field fan.
Bleacher Jeff is right there, man. Come on, get with the program.
He was not. It was a little further towards center.
That's true.
You got to be careful. Yeah, exactly. But it's just a hilarious and delightful tradition that Mets fan fell prey to. Hope the weather holds. It's not supposed to rain, is it? I don't think so. Just a few clouds out there. Hey, Siri, what's the weather today? I'm asking Jose Siri of the Tampa Bay Rays.
He's pretty good.
What the weather is.
Amateur meteorologist, too.
Yeah, oh, he's good at that stuff. Siri and Alexa is my favorite morning show. Those guys work together over at my house. Yeah, nothing. No, we're good.
Those guys ever have Mark Grody on?
They must. I mean, tonight at first pitch, it's going to be 78 and sunny still, as we are just a couple of days away from the longest day of the year that we just passed. I don't think it was the longest home run of the year, but my God, this was satisfying. Now, look, there's a Friday one. There's a Saturday one. Is this the Friday one? Is this the Friday one from against his team for the first time? Or is this yesterday's?
This is yesterday's home run. This is the further one.
That's fine. Then I'll set the scene from Friday. Lefty on lefty, Shohei Ohtani in his first game as a Dodger against the Angels. I was watching in my house, just kind of walking around doing stuff, and it was on, and that home run got hit, and I shrieked alone in my house. That's how firm and powerful that dude's stance is. My goodness, when he makes full contact. And then yesterday he went even further.
Biggio on first, nobody out, top of the order at the plate. That is a rocket heading toward the pavilion. One 459 one night after he went 455.
Stephen Emmett wove just up the sound. See, it's different.
It is different. It is. It was different on Friday. It's different again on Saturday. How many times is going to be different? 24 so far on the season. Actually, 23 for Shohei. I'll have to get to one more today so I can sound correct on that. He is third in home runs in MLB. 24 is the number for Gunnar Henderson of the Baltimore Orioles. Shortstop, rookie of the year last year, with a shot to an MVP. But I'll have to battle this guy from the Yankees who hit his 28th.
Soto at first, one away. Morton to Judge with a 3-1, and it's cracked the other way. Sends Laureano back to the wall and gone. Aaron Judge does it again. 28th of the season. Yankees take the lead.
That is Aaron Judge, who throws the bat down in seeming frustration.
Yeah, but he forgot where he played.
Yeah, and then watches it go. All right, here's a quick question. There are two players within the top 20 of home run hitters who play for local teams. Who are the two players? Sean, they each have 14 homers.
Christopher Morel
and Paul DeYoung. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's the world we live in. Christopher Morel and Paul DeYoung are indeed your leaders. It's an interesting season, that is for damn sure. And I love watching Ohtani. I love watching the superstars of this sport. And I just,
like Paul DeYoung.
Oh God, it would be so nice to have a real good team in town. I thought the Cubs were going to be really good. I really did. It's disappointing spiritually, frankly.
It
does. Now look, good win yesterday. Maybe Tomas Nito is exactly what Jameson Taillon needed. You realize they've got three starters with ERAs under three, and Justin Steele could join them if he has a good start his next time. I think I read that on Bleacher Nation today. Brett Taylor and Michael Cirami doing great work over there, of course. It's hard to be confident in this Cubs bunch right now because you don't know who the closer is, and they need another power bat. And nobody's on the move. Nobody's getting active here for the deadline because so many teams are right in that weird-ass middle of MLB. Oof. We got a few other things we want to get to before we get out of here, including this. This is the end of the Rockies and Nationals game last night. It is our first ever ending like this in MLB.
Two. No pitch. Your pitch clock violation is going to end the game. Wow. Jake Cave scores. Rockies win it 8-7. Finnegan doesn't even argue, just walks off. What a resilient victory for the Rockies. Maybe lost a little bit of the drama with the walk-off pitch clock violation.
So, look, it was Bases loaded, full count, ninth inning for Ryan McMahon. He would say after the game, when you're a kid, those are the moments you dream up. And don't you remember standing in the backyard, swinging the bat, thinking, man, I can't wait to get a pitch clock violation in my favor that gives me an RBI because it turns my at-bat into a walk, and it's a walk-off pitch clock violation.
We've all done it in our backyard, hey, man, come on, since we were kids.
That's what I dream of. Here's the thing, though. If you're like, how can the ump call that? What is he doing? Kyle Finnegan? That's his ninth pitch clock violation on the season. Nobody else has more than five in MLB. Kyle Finnegan is a walking, living, breathing pitch clock violation. So it was bound to happen to him and Hunter Wendelstadt. You know, it's allowing a game to end like that. He's the king. Kyle Finnegan is the king of pitch clock violations. Can't really hold it against Hunter Wendelstadt. There's a lot of other things we could. All right, we are going to get out of here at the top of the hour. I'm going to then head over to Wrigley and be there for the Ryan Sandberg statue unveiling. Cannot wait. We'll report on that tomorrow on the Parkins and Spiegel show. But before we get out of here, the latest in a series of embarrassing moments for the White Sox was Friday, and there was a broadcaster towing the line. I want to bring you that, and then White Sox beat writer Bob Nightingale has also offered us something in his weekly notes column in USA Today. So we'll touch both of those things next on The Score.
To grow a spine, man.
Obviously not a leader.
The premier baseball show in Chicago. Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel.
1-2. That one hit to center as Vierling will make the catch, and DeYoung was not aware of the outs. He's going to get doubled off at first, and that's how the game will end.
Yeah, this is an event away to lose, and that's the way the Sox have been for a bit. That's a little frustrating.
By the way,
yeah,
I see the White Sox lose many, many, many ways this year. That's a new one.
Yeah, that's a new one, all right. Look, I've said before, the White Sox, They're like an improv comic giving you brand new, thoroughly inspired gold every night, every time you go. They are the Robin Williams of losing. Now, look, good win yesterday. Drew Thorpe, an excellent start in his third start. But that thing on Friday, my goodness, with Paul DeYoung forgetting how many outs there are. That was the call as heard on NBC Sports Chicago. The former broadcaster of NBC Sports Chicago, Jason Benetti, former White Sox broadcaster, was doing the game in Detroit. And I immediately went to MLB TV. I'm like, all right, let me hear the longish version here. Let me hear how that registered. Because if you're Jason, you're trying to do a couple of things. You're trying to celebrate the win for the Tigers. You're trying to honestly point out the foibles of the White Sox. And you're trying not to sound vindictive or gleeful in the foibles of the White Sox, because that is unbecoming. And Jason, a dear friend, has more humanity than that. So listen to him kind of toe the line as he handles all those factors in the midst of baseball play-by-play.
Set up there again. Benintendi gives it a ride for center field. Matt Vierling makes the catch.
Oh, they thought it was
Thought there were two out. This is going to be a double play.
Oh, my goodness. What a way to end the game.
The Tigers win, and the White Sox have yet another play that typifies their season. 2-1 Tigers. Thank you very much.
I was like, wait a minute. I thought there's one out.
How
there's
in the out. World does this happen?
You're going to take it. You were going to take it,
and though. Run home. You take it and you run if you're the Tigers.
And for good measure, goes back and makes sure that he re-tags at second base.
Wow.
That's Jason Benetti on the call there on Bally's in Detroit. Sean, you listened further. I haven't heard this. This is another 40 seconds or so after the fact.
So DeYoung forgot how many outs there were, and a gathering of angels appeared above the Tigers' heads.
I mean, and it's a constant reminder. You know that they're telling them exactly how many outs there are. You're the tying run.
Wow. I don't know that I've ever seen that to end a game.
No. Not at all. And I don't know what your reaction was, but I had to double check
to make sure
there was one out.
I didn't even think that there was any chance that somebody would do that. But you know what? The rain's coming at the perfect time, evidently. A win's a win, Dan.
Absolutely. And they'll take it all night long.
So from the Tigers' perspective, taking that win. And Benetti channeling sticks, quoting Dennis DeYoung from Come Sail Away right there. Remember when I was a kid, I thought that there were two different songs that were on the radio a lot. One was called Come Sail Away and one was called I'm Sailing Away. And it turns out one was just one part of the song and one was the other part of the same song. I quickly learned that was not true. Fun fact, I also thought that bands that were on the radio were actually at the radio station playing in a studio. Like one band would finish up in one room, and as they would segue to the other song, it was another band in another room. And then very quickly, the first band would clear out and the other band would go set up and they would go back and forth. Like I had all of this worked out in my mind. I thought that's how radio worked.
I didn't even think that there was any chance that somebody would do that.
Well, I did. I thought that's exactly how they would do it. This from Bob Nightingale in his USA Today. Today, baseball column, his weekly Sunday column, where Around the Base Paths invariably starts with a White Sox nugget that, well, you can figure out where he got it. Here's one. While Chicago White Sox manager Pedro Grifol's future is uncertain past this season, one name that is floating around internally as a potential replacement in 2025 is Skip Schumacher, manager of the Miami Marlins. Schumacher, the reigning National League Manager of the Year, played 7 years in St. Louis for Tony La Russa, who will be an integral part of the decision-making process. Integral part of the decision-making process. Folks, Tony La Russa is the shadow president of baseball operations for the Chicago White Sox. He is a boss to Chris Getz. He is an ally to Jerry Reinsdorf. And he is very much a source for Bob Nightingale.
David Eckstein.
Skip Schumacher's a good manager, seemingly a very good manager. It'd be interesting to know whether he would indeed want to go to the White Sox, maybe a year removed from the current state of ugliness, maybe the opportunity to write his own ticket on some levels. But, you know, you're Skip Schumacher, you might have a lot of choices. I don't know if the White Sox would be your choice, but maybe they would. My goodness. That whole situation is exhausting, but we'll have plenty of time to deal with it. A simple way to listen to this show or to Mully and Haw, Bernsey and Holmes, Parkins and Spiegel, and everything we have to offer here at The Score is the free Odyssey app. Follow 670 The Score in the Odyssey app and take us wherever you may go. Rewind on this show to hear the conversation with Bob Costas earlier this hour, to hear the conversation with Lawrence Holmes at the top of the 10 o'clock hour about Rickwood and Reggie Jackson and Dick Allen. Really, really worthwhile stuff. And Colton Brewer, who might be the closer today for the Cubs? I don't know. He was on at 10:30. Thank you to all those guests. Thank you to you, the callers, the texters, for being involved. Thank you to Sean Sears for doing a great job on Hit and Run. I'll see you over at Wrigley. Say hello. Have a wonderful sports day, everyone. And I'll talk to you tomorrow as part of Parkins and Spiegel at 2 o'clock. Have a great rest of your day. Thanks for listening.
To grow a spine, man.
Obviously not a leader.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking Spunks puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in-store or at mybobs.com to play now.
The premier baseball show in Chicago. Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel.
1-2. That one hit to center as Vierling
will make the catch. And
DeYoung
gonna
get back.
Was not aware of the outs. He's going to get doubled off at first, and that's how the game will end.
Yeah, this is an event away to lose, and that's the way the Sox have been for a bit. That's a little frustrating.
By the way,
yeah,
I see the White Sox lose many, many, many ways this year. That's a new one.
Yeah, that's a new one, all right. Look, I've said before, the White Sox, they're like an improv comic giving you brand new, thoroughly inspired gold every night, every time you go. They are the Robin Williams of losing. Now, look, good win yesterday. Drew Thorpe, an excellent start in his third start. But that thing on Friday, my goodness, with Paul DeYoung forgetting how many outs there are. That was the call as heard on NBC Sports Chicago. The former broadcaster of NBC Sports Chicago, Jason Benetti, former White Sox broadcaster, was doing the game in Detroit. And I immediately went to MLB TV. I'm like, all right, let me hear the longest version here. Let me hear how that registered. Because if you're Jason, you're trying to do a couple of things. You're trying to celebrate the win for the Tigers. You're trying to honestly point out the foibles of the White Sox. And you're trying not to sound vindictive or gleeful in the foibles of the White Sox, because that is unbecoming. And Jason, a dear friend, has more humanity than that. So listen to him kind of toe the line as he handles all those factors in the midst of baseball play-by-play.
Set up there again. Benintendi gives it a ride for center field. Matt Vierling makes the catch.
Oh, they thought it was
And wow, they
outs.
Thought there were two out. This is going to be a double play.
Oh, my goodness. What a way to end the game.
The Tigers win, and the White Sox have yet another play that typifies their season. 2-1 Tigers. Thank you very much.
I was like, wait a minute. I thought there's one out.
How
there's
in the
out.
World does this happen?
You're going to take it. You are going to take it,
and
though.
Run home. You take it and you run if you're the
and
Tigers.
And for good measure, goes back and makes sure that he re-tags at second base.
Wow.
That's Jason Benetti on the call there on Bally's in Detroit. Sean, you listened further. I haven't heard this. This is another 40 seconds or so after the fact.
So DeYoung forgot how many outs there were, and a gathering of angels appeared above the Tigers' heads.
I mean, and it's a constant reminder. You know that they're telling them exactly how many outs there are. You're the tying run.
Wow. I don't know that I've ever seen that to end a game.
No, not at all. And I don't know what your reaction was, but I had to double check
to make sure
there was one out.
I didn't even think that there was any chance that somebody would do that. But you know what? The rain's coming at the perfect time, evidently. You know, a win's a win, Dan.
Absolutely. And they'll take it all night long.
So, from the Tigers' perspective, taking that win. And Benetti channeling Styx, quoting Dennis DeYoung from Come Sail Away right there. Remember when I was a kid, I thought that there were two different songs that were on the radio a lot. One was called Come Sail Away, and one was called I'm Sailing Away. And it turns out one was just one part of the song, and one was the other part of the same song. I quickly learned that was not true. Fun fact, I also thought that bands that were on the radio were actually at the radio station playing in a studio. Like one band would finish up in one room, and as they would segue to the other song, it was another band in another room. And then very quickly, the first band would clear out and the other band would go set up and they would go back and forth. Like I had all of this worked out in my mind. I thought that's how radio worked.
I didn't even think that there was any chance that somebody would do that.
Well, I did. I thought that's exactly how they would do it. This from Bob Nightingale in his USA Today. Today, baseball column, his weekly Sunday column, where Around the Base Paths invariably starts with a White Sox nugget that, well, you can figure out where he got it. Here's one. While Chicago White Sox manager Pedro Grifol's future is uncertain past this season, one name that is floating around internally as a potential replacement in 2025 is Skip Schumacher, manager of the Miami Marlins. Schumacher, the reigning National League Manager of the Year, played 7 years in St. Louis for Tony La Russa, who will be an integral part of the decision-making process. Folks, Tony La Russa is the shadow president of baseball operations for the Chicago White Sox. He is a boss to Chris Getz. He is an ally to Jerry Reinsdorf, and he is very much a source for Bob Nightingale.
David Eckstein.
Skip Schumacher is a good manager, seemingly a very good manager. It'd be interesting to know whether he would indeed want to go to the White Sox, maybe a year removed from the current state of ugliness, maybe the opportunity to write his own ticket on some levels, but, you know, you're Skip Schumacher, you might have a lot of choices. I don't know if the White Sox would be your choice, but maybe they would. My goodness. That whole situation is exhausting, but we'll have plenty of time to deal with it. A simple way to listen to this show or to Mully and Haw, Bernsey and Holmes, Parkins and Spiegel, and everything we have to offer here at The Score is the free Odyssey app. Follow 670 The Score in the Odyssey app and take us wherever you may go. Rewind on this show to hear the conversation with Bob Costas earlier this hour, to hear the conversation with Lawrence Holmes at the top of the 10 o'clock hour about Rickwood and Reggie Jackson and Dick Allen. Really, really worthwhile stuff. And Colton Brewer, who might be the closer today for the Cubs? I don't know. He was on at 10:30. Thank you to all those guests. Thank you to you, the callers, the texters, for being involved. Thank you to Sean Sears for doing a great job on Hit and Run. I'll see you over at Wrigley. Say hello. Have a wonderful sports day, everyone. And I'll talk to you tomorrow as part of Parkins and Spiegel at 2 o'clock. Have a great rest of your day. Thanks for listening.
To grow a spine, man.
Obviously not a leader.
From the mind of a 2-foot-tall talking Spunks puppet comes this year's biggest challenge. It's time for Bob's Dare to Compare. The hottest game show on TV that asks, what happens when you compare Bob's to the competition? You get style. You get quality. You get beeps and boops and dings and whomps. And thousands of dollars in savings. Everyone's a winner when you dare to compare with Bob's Discount Furniture. Shop in store or at mybobs.com to play now.